Chapter 14, Elegy in a Jewish Graveyard. It is high summer, 1994. Computer disks and numerous files and folders have long since replaced the green Prince's Garden school notebooks. My vocabulary now embraces words that would do Miss Crone proud. I am a guest professor in Gießen, teaching the literature of exile that was written by Germans and Austrians who fled after Hitler came to power. The prospect of a long weekend in Bavaria offers a welcome reprieve from the scrutiny of young Germans who know surprisingly little about the fate of writers, most of them Jews, who had to flee from the Nazi Reich in the 30s. I'm working hard to earn their respect. Despite my surname, it helps that I'm not German. They are more interested in my native roots in Northern Ireland than my years in the United States. Anna Seeger's short story, Der Ausflug der Toten Mädchen, The Excursion of the Dead Girls, finally breaks the ice. And they begin to talk about the burden of their legacy, reluctantly handed down from their parents, who had dealt with even worse, the silence of their grandparents. They were clearly moved by the power of the Seeger story, which connected them to a past that was a painful part of their heritage. As we drive through the narrow streets of Harburg, the smell of cow dung hangs unequivocally in the air. We, my husband and I, are heading for a farm located at the far end of the village where Mr. T is expecting us and will lead us to the Jewish cemetery. He will climb up on an ancient tractor that looks to me like the old Massey Ferguson we had in Ballycone. And we will follow him up into the hills that surround Harburg. Just a few minutes before, we had turned off the Romantische Straße, the famous road with gentle curves and gracefully undulating hills that bears the daily burden of luxury coaches headed for Munich, with tourists who have already stopped for coffee or lunch in fragrant little Dinkelsbühl, or Rottenburg up der Taube. I do not suppose they will stop in Harburg. Dung is fundamentally dung, but the Bavarian variety strikes a nose seasoned on a county down farm as particularly pungent. And it's not hard to work out why. Dung enjoys an astonishing degree of freedom in this part of the world and is permitted to ferment right under the apron of the town on farms like Mr. T's, as opposed to wafting half-baked in the open countryside over hawthorn hedgerows, diluted by every breeze that wanders by. Mr. T does not know that I hold these views, nor that I am observing his hands and am poised to impose yet another obsessive connection, namely that his fingers look just as swollen and cracked as their North Irish counterparts from working with cows' tough hindquarters. He's Willie John with a Bavarian accent. The Massey Ferguson struggles up the sharp incline, giving us ample time to look back at the receding profile of Harburg, the castle of the Oettingen-Wallerstein family, imperiously etched on the steep hill. Its presence, though now symbolic, a dramatic reminder of the power structure that shaped these picturesque little Bavarian farm towns. And we thought Erwin, the landlord, had power. A car is parked at the side of the walled graveyard, which Mr. T explains belongs to Mr. H, who has been working on the restoration of the gravestones for some time and would certainly be glad to meet someone involved in Jewish studies. There we stand. The Bavarian farmer, probably now in his 70s, whose father and grandfather had tended this same cemetery and had performed Sabbath chores for local Jewish farmers. The journalist Mr. H, who had sought out healthier air than his native Stuttgart offered, and now, as one of the few Jews in the area, is writing articles for the Donauwörther Zeitung about the former Jewish community in Harburg. And my husband and I, who just the night before had first heard about Harburg's Jewish cemetery at the church picnic of Ehlingen Lutheran Church. This is how we ended up at a church picnic. It was early evening by the time we finally located the tiny hamlet of Schopfloa, where my husband's great-great-grandfather, Franz Hansa, had been the minister of the local Lutheran church. We had thought that we were looking for Schopfloch, which would have satisfied another desire to visit the place. A Jewish colleague whose ancestors came from there had told me a fascinating story. 200 years ago in Schopfloch, Lutheran cattle dealers joined with Jewish cattle dealers to protect both themselves and one another against the unfair business practices of cattle dealers from other farming communities in the area. Together, they developed a Hebrew-based language called Lachudish, which they used during business deals to communicate with each other. The language survived even the Third Reich and is spoken today by several people in the little town, including the mayor. But Schopfloch expelled its Jewish population in the 30s. A common language and a love for cattle were not enough to confront an ideology that stripped Jews of their right to be farmers, of their right to be Germans, and ultimately of their right to live. I had even been able to meet the mayor briefly, as it turned out. I should have made an appointment, he pointed out firmly. But yes, the church would have a list of former ministers that went back several centuries. But there were no Hansers on the list that I carefully scrutinized in the parsonage office, for which I was grateful when my eyes later fell on the mural at the front of the church, which depicts Jesus and his disciples as blonde Aryans and was painted in 1935. Maybe we should try another place called Schopfloa, the pastor suggested. It was about 50 kilometers away. I asked him whether the mural was an insult to both Jews and Christians. It's history, he replied. So, it was with a certain weariness and few expectations that we pulled up in the little farm village of Schopfloa. The first person we met was a woman by the name of Reichhardt, who was watering geraniums on her husband's grave. He had fallen over dead in his early 40s, she later explained. She was able to tell us that the pastor had the only key to the church, but he lived in Ehlingen, where he also was pastor of another small Lutheran congregation. But then maybe the organist had a key, and she would gladly drive with us the 500 yards or so up the village to his farm. Nothing was a bother to the amiable Frau Reichhardt, who brightened at the mention of Franz Hanser and knew there were both a photo of Franz Hanser and a chronicle written by him inside the church. But first she removed her headscarf, before setting off for the 2-minute drive to the organist's, who in fact did not have a key, but knew that the pastor at that very hour was attending the annual Ehlingen Lutheran Church Choir picnic. But first, he must change out of his farm clothes. And only then were we on our way to the choir picnic. But not before we had driven Mrs. Reichart back to the watering can waiting by the grave of her late husband, whose biography had meanwhile grown, especially during the time the organist was changing his clothes. Herr Reichart had been married before and had brought several children into the second marriage with Frau Reichart, who had loved them all, but especially the boy who had died of a disease that eluded me in the middle of a fiercely Bavarian consonant cluster. By now I would have gladly stayed with Frau Reichart and helped her water the flowers, except I would probably have to change into working clothes. Within 10 minutes, we were in a field near Ehlingen. Two people who could barely hold a tune, invited by the minister to partake at the high table of Ehlingen Church Choir, alongside the choir director, a dairy farmer when he was not singing. Choir offspring played in a sandpile that had been dumped on the grass for the occasion. The sun was now sinking on the heels of a hot day, and the crack was good, sweetened by a Bavarian dialect that rolled its freilich, of course, halfway up the country and back. We were welcome guests, for after all, we were related to Pastor Franz Hansa, whose photo and chronicle were in the church office, and the Reverend T would return with us in tow to the little church, ja, freilich, after we had finished eating, and then he would come back for the post-picnic activities. Indeed, apart from the incongruity of an imported sandpile, the event could have been a belated wake for Franz Hanser, not in the celebrator's life sense, but as an occasion to tuck into a hearty meal in a field with Franz's friends. There would, of course, have been more reverent reflection had we known at the picnic wake of how he had found the strength to cope with rearing a brood of motherless children after his wife died in childbirth, and the frustration of having to defend his support of the 1848 political uprisings would certainly have drawn from us a respectful comment. We did not ask the present choir director if he supported Franz Hanser's political views, for after all, it was 1994, and we would not learn about Franz's position toward 1848 till later, in the back office of the church in Schopfloa. For now, it was enough to tell at high table what we did know, that Franz Hanser's son Otto had emigrated to America, and Otto's granddaughter married a Lutheran pastor from Wisconsin and ended up in a town called Horicon. Surely this kinship gave us as much right as any Bavarian Lutheran or not to be present on this balmy July evening in 1994. The children, long since bored with the sandpile, were now chasing one another up and down the field. Besides, who better to talk to than German dairy farmers about the price of milk in Northern Ireland? Sooner or later, the conversation would drift to where I had learned to speak German. A harmless enough inquiry as long as it stayed in Belfast. But ultimately, the conversation found its way beyond Belfast to my area of research on the Holocaust. the word fell on the Ailingen church choir picnic like a zeppelin. Rescued only by the young pastor's hearty suggestion that I meet his father, who tended the Jewish cemetery in Harburg, just a few miles away from the Romantische Straße. It would not take us out of the way to our destination of Munich, actually the archives at Dachau. I refrained from giving the specific destination. And that's how we came to be standing the next morning with Mr. T and Mr. H in the Jewish cemetery in Harburg after spending the night in Nördlingen. The minister had phoned his father when he got home from the picnic, and now the elderly man was expecting us. We stood for a long time, the German Jew and the North Irish woman, while my American husband wandered off with Mr. T among the graves, gamely trying to speak German. The journalist and I, however, were already talking with the particular kind of intensity that comes from working for years with documents on people whose lives have become part of one's own. There had been a flourishing Jewish community in the 18th and 19th centuries in Harburg, I learned. After days of scrubbing and rubbing, the names on the gravestones were appearing under Mr. H's persistent hands. He was visibly disappointed that I could not help him decipher the Hebrew inscriptions. After I returned to Wisconsin, I received copies of four articles that Mr. H had written for the Donauwörter Zeitung, describing the lives of people like Isaac Stein, who was born in 1877 in Harburg, studied in Berlin, and in 1902 wrote his doctoral dissertation, The Jews in the Swabian Imperial Cities During the Reign of King Sigmund, 1410-37. By the time he was 27, Stein was the district rabbi of Memel. He died in Berlin in 1915 of kidney failure and was buried in Harburg with rabbis in attendance from Ansbach and Tilsit. His grave has vanished. Raphael May was also born in Harburg in 1806, studied medicine at the University of Würzburg, and after being licensed to practice medicine in Munich, returned to Harburg to take care of the workers when the railroad was built between 1845 and 1850. The mayor of Harburg recommended Dr. May for the Order of St. Michael after 50 years of devoted service. The doctor had traced the source of a smallpox epidemic in 1840 to a weaver who had infected his customers. Sadly, the officials in Augsburg did not agree with the recommendation of the Harburg mayor. But Mr. H points out in his article that Dr. May nonetheless continued with his medical practice, making no difference in his treatment of Jews and Christians. The original of the letter outlining the refusal is in the archives of the Oettingen Wallerstein Castle in Harburg. Then there was the Gultmann family, which lived in Harburg for 200 years, starting with Lemli Alexander, who was given permission to reside in Harburg in 1745. Schutzaufnahme, a protective measure. The butcher, Chaim Hirsch Gultmann, spent his whole life in Harburg from 1804 until 1886. His son Leopold emigrated to the United States in 1870, about the time that Otto Hanser left shop floor, and arrived in New York on the Cimbria, Leopold headed for Watertown, Wisconsin, and spent 7 years working in a department store before ending up in Colorado, where he founded the Golden Eagle Dry Goods Company. Leopold Gultman died in Denver in 1936, leaving a rich legacy to Colorado as a distinguished philanthropist. Moritz Guggenheimer, one of the founders of the famous Bayerische Vereinsbank, 1869 in Munich, along with such prominent businessmen as Karl Freiherr von Eichthal and Emil von Hirsch, was born in Harburg in 1825, just like his father before him and his great-grandfather Israel Guggenheimer, whose house used to stand opposite the Harburger Synagogue at the juncture of the Judengasse and the Nördlinger Straße. The house had to be torn down a few years ago because it was structurally unsound. Moritz Guggenheimer, writes Mr. H., made a significant contribution to the development of Munich as a modern metropolis. He further points out that Moritz's neighbor in the fashionable Arkestrasse was Alfred Pringsheim, the father-in-law of Thomas Mann, the same man who should have gone with us for a dip in the sea near Newcastle. And to think that Dr. Mai and Moritz Guggenheimer were born in Harburg, the little town that I still see resting so quietly on that sunny July morning on the side of the steep hill. Not that my own perspective was low. The Jewish cemetery is in fact on the Hühnerberg, Chicken Hill. One could translate Berg as mountain, but that would convey the wrong meaning, for this is a hill. Otherwise, the Massey Ferguson would never have made it. Mr. H. paused to address Mr. T., who had just approached. "It's always peaceful here, isn't it, Mr. T.?" he said. And I translate. I could also translate it. "It's not dreich here." I had just commented on how inviting and quiet the little graveyard was. Mr. T. said he didn't notice because he came here to work, just like his father and his grandfather before him. I thought much later, realizing that he could have said something else, something a bit more poetic, but it would have been contrived and untrue, and Mr. H. would have seen right through it. It certainly would have been easier to talk about Belfast at the Ehlingen Lutheran Church Choir picnic than about the Holocaust. And it would have been so comforting to find gravestones in the Harburg Cemetery that post-dated the beginning of the Third Reich. But there was only one, and it was dated 1935. The weight of history that lies on Germany is enormous. There's no way around it. And now to be saddled with willing executioner's label. Yet there are hidden places off its main roads, in this case the famous Romantische Straße, that would be easy to drive by. These undiscovered nooks of Bavaria do not solve or absolve history any more than schoolrooms, non-sectarian pigeon clubs, or the cattle marts of Northern Ireland do, but they suggest that there are places where the burdens of the day and the even heavier load of facing one's own mortality can rest, if briefly, in a little graveyard beyond the scourge of collective guilt and national stereotype. Yet, sadly, these are not the places that our leaders visit What a pity that President Reagan's advisors did not tell him to keep on driving past Bitburg and head for the little cemetery in Harburg. You would think that I would have asked Mr. H. what happened after 1933, but I didn't, for I already knew the answer. The German poet Ilse Blumenthal-Weiss, a survivor of the Holocaust, once said that she wanted to write about the sun, but the night kept breaking through. It was so peaceful that day up on the Hühnerberg. Its peacefulness captivated me for a brief moment and inserted temporary parentheses in the German-Jewish relationship, which was forged as much by the rough hands of the Lutheran farmer as the persistent hands of the Jewish journalist. Theirs is a silent, unsung partnership that insists on a life that once was and that must be preserved by rubbing and scrubbing until the names are coaxed back into the light. Mr. H. later wrote that the gravestones, and I translate, have turned out unexpectedly beautiful. He has still more articles to send me, the second of which will deal directly with the graveyard up on the Hühnerberg. God willing, I'll write about that later, so I will.